Welcome to the Free Will Show, a podcast that provides a beginner-friendly introduction to free will while also exploring cutting-edge developments on the topic. I'm Taylor Sear.
And I'm Matt Plummer. In this episode, we talk about Aquinas' views of free will and human agency with Harm Goris.
Thanks for listening. I'm happy to introduce Harm Goris, Assistant Professor of Dogmatic Theology at Tilburg University. Harm's main areas of specialization are Thomas Aquinas, Reformed Scholastic Theology, and Contemporary Philosophy of Religion. One publication that may be of special interest to our listeners is the chapter that Harm wrote on Thomas Aquinas for the Routledge Companion to Free Will. And we'll focus on some of the ideas in that chapter today, but we'll also ask a couple of broader questions about Thomas Aquinas' place in debates about free will today. Welcome to the show, Harm. Thanks for joining us. Could you start by telling us a bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on issues related to free will?
Yeah, thank you, Taylor. Thank you, Matt, for having me. Mm-hmm. Well, free will, I started thinking about it already as a young kid, but then when during my studies in theology, of course, we had to do Augustine and Pelagius and Erasmus and Luther. Mm-hmm. Of course, I was very much in favor of Pelagius and of Erasmus. And the older I got, the more pessimistic or maybe realistic I became. So nowadays, you know, I'm tending more into Augustine's view on free will, which basically means that the most important thing is not that we have free will, but that our will becomes free, that we are liberated, that our will is liberated. So that's what interests me now. But I did some earlier work on divine foreknowledge and divine causation. And so I guess we can also talk about that, not only about Augustine and us being slaves of sin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Thomas Aquinas has come up on the podcast before, including an episode a little over a year ago with Gloria Frost on divine causation. Mm-hmm. But this will be our first time spending an entire episode on Aquinas. Could you start by giving us a bit of historical context? When did he live? Who were some of his influences? What are some of his most widely read texts and any other background that you think might be helpful?
Sure. Thomas Aquinas lived in 13th century, 1225 to 1274. And that was a period when universities emerged in Europe as new centers of learning. So no longer the monasteries with monastic theology and with a kind of theological training that was aimed at the spiritual formation of future monks, but rather the universities where students are instructed in not becoming devout persons or good monks, but in becoming good intellectuals. Mm-hmm. And a major influence or major change in the 13th century was that the works of Aristotle were rediscovered in Europe. Before that time, Augustine and Augustine's Platonism was like the major default way of thinking. And so Plato and Augustine are much more into, well, you know, you can find the truth not through empirical observation, but, you know, by turning within yourself and waiting for divine illumination and inspiration. While Aristotle has a much more what we could call an empirical, rational approach to reality and also to faith. You know, you have to argue, you have to think, you have to make distinctions, etc. So a different way of doing theology, of doing philosophy than was common, you know, up to, let's say, the 12th century. Mm-hmm. His major works were nowadays, it's the Summa Theologiae. It's a big work, mm-hmm. and he wrote it on his own initiative. And that became, as of the 16th century, the Summa Theologiae became the standard textbook for theological training in Catholic universities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, in your chapter on Aquinas in the Routledge Companion to Free Will, you say that Aquinas discusses human free will in many places, but you sort some of the important ones under two main headings, theological and anthropological. And we want to talk about both sets of issues. So first, one of the theological issues concerns divine foreknowledge. How does Aquinas respond to the worry that divine foreknowledge precludes human free will?
Yeah. I think the major issue for Aquinas is if we assume that God has perfect and certain foreknowledge of the whole future, that implies that the whole future is already somehow fixed, determined, settled. And that implies what we nowadays would call a specific theory of time, labeled the eternalist view or the block universe view or static view, which basically says that there is no modal difference, so there is no difference as to necessity or contingency between on the one hand past and present and on the other hand future. Mm-hmm. So on this block universe, the whole of reality is like a four-dimensional matrix where what happens to be future for us now is in itself as settled, as determinate as what for us is now past. And so, and that's on this view on time, the future is as settled or unchangeable as the past and the present is. The only thing is that we cannot know the future, but in itself, what is future to us in itself is just as fixed as the past is. And Thomas thinks that that is a threat to human freedom, because I think we, all of us, you know, like normal people, not philosophers and theologians, we have this idea, well, somehow the future is open. It's not settled, it's not fixed. And that is what Aquinas wants to save, I think, this folk idea of, well, unlike the past and the present, the future is open. Mm-hmm. So that nowadays that would be called in the philosophy of time a moving block universe or a dynamic view on time with an open future. But of course, if you have an open future, then it seems impossible that God can foreknow that. And so in my view, Aquinas has this theory of time with an open future. And yet he says we have to say that God foreknows the future, although in itself the future is just open and unsettled. Mm-hmm. But God, we have to say that God foreknows that future because of his special mode of being, that is eternity. He is eternal. And of course we want to make like pictures of that, but we can't picture God. That would be kind of idolatry or blasphemy. So for Aquinas, I would say, I think that, take, for example, future contingent propositions, so that sentences about future contingencies. Well, mm-hmm. The classical example is from Aristotle, the proposition, tomorrow there will be a sea battle. Mm-hmm. Well, Aristotle discusses this in the Perihermeneias, chapter 9, and he says, well, if that is a normal proposition, and a proposition or a sentence or statement is something that is either true or false. So if the proposition tomorrow there will be a sea battle, if that's true, then there must be a sea battle tomorrow. On the other hand, if the sentence tomorrow there will be a sea battle is false, there cannot be a sea battle tomorrow. But in my view, Aquinas says that it is neither true nor false that there will be a sea battle tomorrow, because it's open, it's undetermined. And yet we have to say that God foreknows it. But we cannot say, we cannot explain, we cannot articulate what God foreknows or how God foreknows, because we always use propositions, and propositions entail tenses, grammatical tenses. So we can only express things about the future using a temporal mode of expression, using tensed propositions. The only thing we can say, well, this is not how God foreknows the future. Mm-hmm. So in my view, Aquinas can both maintain that the future is open, undetermined, and that statements about future contingencies are neither true nor false, and yet at the same time also claim that God has foreknowledge. Does that make sense?
I think so.
A different theological issue is divine causality, and whether Aquinas' view of God's causality implies that what we do is causally determined. How does Aquinas address the issue of divine causality?
Yeah. So this is another problem, and I think it has to be well distinguished from the problem we talked about before. So divine foreknowledge of the future. In the history of Thomism, I must say that, especially as of the 16th century, the idea was, well, the whole of God's foreknowledge can be explained through God's will. So God wills from eternity, for example, that there will be a sea battle tomorrow. So, and because of this eternal decree of God's will, God knows from eternity that will happen. But if you talk about God's will, you have to distinguish two different sentences, or two different senses, two different meanings in which we talk about God's will. The first is that we can talk about God's will as what is called an imminent act. So an act that is between God's ears, so to say. So something that God does from eternity. The second way we can talk, and also Scripture talks about divine will, is not so much as an imminent act, so as something that stays within the divine mind itself, but Scripture, and we also talk about God's will as effecting something outside of God, as producing a temporal effect. So then God's will is no longer understood as something that stays within the divine mind, but then divine will is understood in the sense of causing something outside of God, so causing something in time. So back again to the example of Aristotle, if you take the proposition tomorrow there will be a sea battle, if you take that as an object of divine will, as an imminent act, then it's contingent because God can will whatever he wants. But if you take tomorrow there will be a sea battle, if you take that as the object of God's what's called transient will, so of divine causation, then of course we cannot say that God now causes that there will be a sea battle tomorrow. He will cause that tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So divine will, taken in the sense of causation, is simultaneous with the effect in time. Mm-hmm. So God does not cause now what happens tomorrow, but God causes now what happens now. Mm-hmm. And God's causation is a very peculiar kind of causation, because what God causes is everything. Everything to that everything is. God is, for Aquinas, God is the creator of all. And all should be taken in the widest sense possible. So God creates everything, also everything that happens at this very moment, including our free acts. If God would stop causing right now, then immediately you and me and all the listeners and the galaxy and everything would completely vanish into nothingness. Nothingness. So God gives being, gives existence at every to everything at every moment. So God causes also our free actions. If God would not cause our free actions right now, then there would be no free actions at all. So he kind of upholds everything in being. He makes everything be. And he does that, simultaneously with what happens. So every moment, what happens at every moment is caused by God. So don't imagine that God causes something and then, after a few moments, the effect results. No, whatever God causes exists at that very moment. So in this way, Aquinas can maintain that God causes all. God causes all being, including necessary and contingent being. So everything that is necessary is caused by God, but also everything that is free or contingent is caused by God. Because God, if God didn't cause it, it would not exist at all. So there is this difference, in technical terms, it's God as primary cause, which gives the being to everything. Mm-hmm. And there are secondary causes, creatures, us. Mm-hmm. But what we do, what we cause, our causation as such is caused or is upheld by divine causation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's helpful. Well, let's turn now to some anthropological issues that raise questions about free will for Aquinas. One issue you talk about concerns the roles of the intellect and the will. Many philosophers and theologians who distinguish these faculties, intellect and will, have debated the extent to which the will is free from the direction of the intellect. Could you describe how intellect and will are related on Aquinas' view and how free will comes up with respect to debates about voluntarism and intellectualism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, for Aquinas, he never talks, only once or twice, he talks about free will. Usually, he talks about librum arbitrium in Latin. Mm-hmm. So that means free choice. Mm-hmm. And that already indicates that for choosing, it's not only a matter of our will, or of what he calls our appetite, our striving towards something, but choosing also has to do with our intellect, with our understanding. If it would be only, if free choice would only be a matter of the will and would not be rational, then our choices would just be, random or capricious. We would have no reasons, no motives. We would just do, whatever comes up. And for Aquinas, we are rational beings, so that means that we must understand something as a good, as something that can be that can and should be pursued. Mm-hmm. And only if we understand, so by our intellect, understand something as a good, then we as rational beings, we can also will it, we can strive for it, we can go for it. This is very different from, for example, a contemporary or he lived a few years later than Aquinas, Duns Scotus. Duns Scotus is someone who says, he has absolute freedom of the will. So for Scotus, Scotus would even argue that when we are in heaven and when we see God face to face, the will for Scotus would still have the possibility, because of its freedom, to turn away from God. Mm-hmm. For Aquinas, that would be complete nonsense. Mm-hmm. As our will as an intellectual appetite is directed towards the truth and towards the goodness. Well, if we see God, who is the truth itself and goodness itself, it just makes no sense for Aquinas that then the will would turn away from God, because then the will has everything, the truth and the goodness that it strives for. But what I think sometimes what is a problem in Latin is that Latin does not have a definite particle. So in Latin, you cannot make a distinction between a good, something that is good, or the good in absolute sense. And for Aquinas, everything that exists, everything that is created as such is good. There is no absolute evil. So there is always something that can, everything that we want, everything that we choose is something good. So what matters for Aquinas is not that something is a good, but how we order the goods. So what kind of order, what is good and what is better? Mm-hmm. And that is much more important for Aquinas than just, you know, something is a, than the question whether it is a good, because it is always a good. And even, well, fornication is a good in the sense that it gives pleasure, sensual pleasure. And there is nothing wrong with that. But fornication, you know, it deviates from the proper, the right order of goods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then there's, that would be also, then we come probably to the next issue. Whether you see, whether you value something as a good and in which order you value that, that depends very much yourself. On your moral character, on what kind of person you are. So choosing and valuing something as a good for Aquinas is not something that you can do in a kind of objective way, in a kind of calculus or something. It has to do very much with your own personality, with what kind of person you are. If you are a person who is very much into, you know, who thinks that power, having control over other people, if you find that a very good thing, then you will value, you will see reality, your relations to other people within that context. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a related issue, speaking about sin and character, is an anthropological issue about sin.
Yeah.
So could you describe how he takes human nature itself to be affected by sin and what implications this has for the need for divine grace?
Yeah, well, this is, thank you, Matt. This is the topic I've been working on now for the last 3 or 4 years. And I find it very, very difficult. I haven't figured out everything. But talking about human nature, for Aquinas, and I think he's very Augustinian in that sense, for Aquinas, we have human nature. We are true human beings, but our human nature is what he calls, following Augustine, is sick or infected or corrupt. We do not have human nature in the very similar way in which Adam and Eve had it before the fall. By the way, I don't think that that story about the fall is a historical fact, that it actually happened, that there were these two people, Adam and Eve, who lived in perfect harmony with God for a couple of hours or a couple of days and then fell. And also I guess Aquinas himself thought that it was a historical fact that Adam and Eve lived as persons. But if you look at the way he talks about Adam and Eve and about original sin, then he is not so much interested in what happens back then, but in the effects. So for him, Adam and Eve in paradise function more like a kind of counterfactual image. What would God's creation have looked like if sin had not been part of our reality? So what we see around us is not God's good creation, but what we see around us, our actual reality, is God's fallen creation, which is in need of healing and redemption. And okay, back to human nature. So I think that for Aquinas, human nature is somehow infected or sick, and that this sickness or original sin affects all four human powers that are morally relevant. So for our moral action, what matters is not only the will, but also our intellect. We talked about that before. But also our senses, our sensual appetites in scholastic language. So what we nowadays would call emotions or passions. And he distinguishes these in two groups. So there are the passions or emotions that go or strive for something that is good. And there are emotions that help us to overcome obstacles in pursuing what we think is good. So all these moral powers are infected by original sin. So the emotions suffer from what he calls intemperance and weakness. So, for example, liking food and enjoying food, nothing wrong with that. But if it turns into gluttony, you know, or just only, you know, feeding yourself fast food, which can be nice, you know, but if you do that in an intemperate way, if your lust for and your enjoying of food is not moderated by reason, then you do not enjoy food as much as you should and could. So if you take, for example, someone who only lives on fast food, does that person enjoy food as much as someone who has learned to appreciate good food, good French or Californian wines? So all these, sensory enjoyment is something that you should cultivate, that you should develop. And when you do that, Aquinas would say, you enjoy it more. So when your emotions are ruled by reason, you have more pleasure than if you just go for it. And the same would go for sexuality, for example. So these emotions should be ruled by reason, and for that you need to cultivate them. You need to acquire what he calls virtues, you know, kind of dispositions, we would call it nowadays, I guess, character formation. So develop your own personality in such a way that your emotions can also, ruled by reason, can also flourish. But also our intellect and our will are infected by original sin. And with the intellect, I think, and this is something I find is not very well developed in later Thomistic tradition. Very much focus is put on the senses, on the sensory pleasures. But for Aquinas, also the intellect is infected by original sin. Earlier I talked about the right order, the correct order of what is good and what is better. But that's not so obvious, what is good and what is better, what is the right order of goods. So we do not know what the right order is. We have to learn it and we have to develop it and we have to think about it and we have to talk about it to one another, what is good and what is better. So you have to develop that knowledge of right reason, as he calls it. But the most important issue is the most important power that is infected by original sin, that is our will. Mm-hmm. And yeah, what if you ask some, if you, oh, also if I ask myself, what is it that I actually want? You know, of course, I can say, well, I want to write good books on Thomas Aquinas, but that is a means for becoming a full professor at my university, and I want to become a full professor at my university because that will, etc. So you can make a whole range of, well, means for attaining some final goal. But what is it that in the end, what is it that I really want? What are my deepest motives? Where do I think I will find my true happiness? And, well, maybe the older I get, the more pessimistic I become also, in the sense that, I don't know about you, but for me, myself, I'm not fully transparent for myself. I cannot fully see, or I do not fully want to see what my deepest motives are. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, we, and also in the United States, you often talk about dreams, you know, follow your dreams and make your dreams come true, and the American dream. But dreams can become nightmares.
Yeah.
We appreciate it, and you know, we think that people who put everything aside to win a gold medal at the Olympic Games, we find them heroes. And of course, we should appreciate, you know, the effort that these sportsmen and women make. But sometimes I think, can it also become a waste of your life that you spend so much time and your diet and you know, not seeing friends because you have to exercise and is that, yeah, you know, winning a gold medal? And of course, most people who make an effort will never make it to the Olympic Games. So these dreams that people have, that maybe we're not always as conscious as, for example, the person who wants to become an Olympic gold medal winner. But these deepest dreams or motives can also, well, enslave us. And I think that's what Scripture and Augustine and Aquinas means when we say we are slaves of sin. That somehow these deepest motives, of which we are often not even aware ourselves, yeah, but they do, they make our lives, or they do give a thrust to our lives in what we do and what we choose. And yeah, maybe it's only when, well, Aquinas would say true happiness is to love God. And sometimes if a person can really, well, experience or believe that, only then you can look backwards, and only that, you know, from that love of God is revealed the darker tendencies, so to say, in your life that push you into other directions. Am I, is this a sermon, or is this a kind of...
A little bit of both.
I think that's what happens when you start explaining Aquinas' view on these things. Yeah. If I could ask a quick follow-up here, especially about the idea of true happiness for Aquinas being found in love of God, do you have a view about what he thinks the role of the human being is in coming to love God? I know, given his view about our sickness and our sinful condition, we need divine aid, we need grace, but does human agency play a role in responding to that aid?
Well, responding, Taylor, Aquinas would not use that word.
Sure.
But we are, of course, we are not puppets on a string.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say what grace does is set us free, or at least prepare us to set us free. That I find it important to mention that grace for Aquinas is not something that only belongs to the devout Christians. Grace is also is an activity of God with which God is helping all of creation, all human beings, in finding their way back to God, so to say. So, well, in technical terms, that would be called like prevenient grace or something. Mm-hmm. So God is already, from the very beginning of history, I would say, is helping humankind, is helping all human beings in overcoming these wounds original sin. And the human agency, of course, does play a role in this, but don't picture it as if God gives a kind of offer of grace, and then it's up to us to say yes or no. Mm-hmm. This is a very attractive picture, I imagine. And there are also many Catholic theologians who give this kind of idea. So it's up to us to respond to God's offer of grace. But I would say God's offer of grace, or God's gracious activity is always transformative. It's always changing us. And we have to overcome obstacles in ourselves, in our longings and fears for security or for power or for wealth. And it is God's continuous gracious activity that helps us in overcoming these tendencies in ourselves. But we shouldn't picture God as an agent next to or besides us as agents, because earlier I mentioned God's primary causality of God as first cause. Mm-hmm. God makes everything be. So also what I do and what I want and how I respond, that is an effect of God's gracious
right
activity.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Well, as we kind of wrap up with a couple of concluding questions, and keeping in mind that it's sometimes difficult to situate historical figures into the categories or camps of today's debates, do you have a view on whether Aquinas is a compatibilist about free will or some sort of libertarian? Or are there any other thinkers that you think he has a lot or maybe the most in common with?
Yeah, now I would say that Aquinas is a libertarian, has a libertarian view on freedom. But I think what especially in philosophy or among philosophers of free will is not so much taken into account is this whole idea of original sin. Of course, it is a theological issue.
Right.
And philosophers do not deal ex professo with these kind of questions. But I would say it's much more realistic to take original sin into account, and that somehow, but this is an area I would like to explain more also myself, to find a kind of way in between theology and psychology or pastoral counseling or things like that. So it's not thinking about free will should not be, or I tried to make it not only a matter of armchair theology or armchair philosophy, but to think about free will in discussion or in interaction with real people and also with myself as a real normal person and not just as an intellectual. So it's my impression that among philosophers of religion, there is a kind of tendency to do too much analytical armchair thinking. And maybe it would be better to engage more with real life issues and real life persons.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Harm, for joining us. Where can listeners go to follow your work?
Okay, yeah, I try to put regularly stuff on academia.edu. Yeah, that would be, I guess, the best place for listeners to go to if they are aren't fed up with what I've said so far. Want to hear something more?
And we'll link that website in our show notes so people can find it easily. Well, thanks again for joining us, Harm. This has been great.
Okay, thanks for having me, and good luck.
In our next episode, which will be the final episode of this season, we'll talk about John Duns Scotus, and our guest will be Thomas Williams, Isabel A. and Henry D. Martin Professor of Medieval Philosophy at Georgetown University.